Okay, welcome, dear listeners, to another edition of the Jacobs Podcast. And I'm very excited about this one because returning to the show is WIG Capital's Jordan Shopov. Jordan, welcome back.
Thanks, Sean. I'm back from exile. You've let me back onto the show.
Yeah, we decided to get you back in. It had been a long time, but yeah, we figured that stint away, that stint of reflection is probably it's a good time to have you back. Now, you have been away. Where exactly have you been?
Yeah, I was went on vacation with my wife for 6 weeks around Western Australia. So yeah, we were trapped in a van together. Great way to test a marriage. So we got through it, and yeah, now I'm back and back into work. But yeah, no, it was a good trip. And yeah, but it was hard listening to a couple of your podcasts, like doing an episode with Will without me. That was really hard to listen to. But yeah, thanks for letting me back on. I'm excited to be here again.
Cool. Well, yeah, it is very good to have you back. And I presume Warren Buffett or Adam Smith served as a bit of a pressure valve for you. Being able to connect with those chaps was a good thing.
Yeah, I got a fair bit of reading time in, so that was probably the best part of the trip for me. Just took a lot of books and just plowed through them. My wife wouldn't be too happy to hear that. There was a lot of other things we did, but yeah, it was certainly a balance of tourist activities and a lot of reading. Yeah,
cool. Yeah, oh, good stuff. And good to hear. And it's good to have you back, Jordan. And this episode, I thought we'd do something different, or something we have tried before, and just flip things around. And the topic we wanted to cover was the potentially looming monarchy versus republic debate in Australia. And what we're going to do is I'll pass the microphone, the interviewer's mic, to Jordan, and he'll pepper me and cross-examine me with a few questions on the background to this, and what I hope can be a fair primer. But full disclosure, I am a spokesman for the Australian Monarchist League and a member of the Australians for Constitutional Monarchy. So I do come at it from, that perspective. But I do hope that this can be an informative primer for anyone listening out there, and I can give a fair and balanced view, or at least a monarchist perspective, on where I think that we've got a good, stable system here. But again, I thought it was a good way to deliver a bit of a primer on what this issue could actually, on this issue potentially arising post-federal election, because as listeners might be aware, Bill Shorten has promised to hold a referendum on this issue if he wins the Prime Ministership, whereas Scott Morrison is a current Prime Minister, is a constitutional monarchist. So, it's probably an area, a very key distinction between the two figures underneath all of the policies and the manifestos. This could be a potentially big seismic outcome following the election. So I look forward to this, but yeah, interviewer's microphone over to you, Jordan.
Thanks, Sean. So yeah, firstly, thanks for being part of the Jacobs podcast series. And
happy to participate.
Yeah, it's, now I'm glad you had that bit of disclosure at the front end, because yeah, I'm going to, in case listeners are worried that I'm going to give you a free ride, I'll try and push back on you. But yeah, we'll hopefully make this a bit more of a debate rather than just a one-sided take on constitutional monarchy in Australia. So, but I think it's important to, let's kind of look at the historical context a bit, and go back through the recent history of how this issue has played out. Particularly, I was interested to get your thoughts on what happened the last time Australia had a referendum in the 90s. For those people who weren't aware, this issue has, been debated and had out before. And I was wondering if you could run through, some of the circumstances of that referendum, like what the main arguments of each side was, who some of the more notable campaigners were, and perhaps any reasons why you think the outcome turned out the way it did.
Yeah, fair enough. You're right, Jordan. We have had this issue pop up before. There was a referendum on this issue in 1999, and the Republicans lost that. So around 54%, so about 6.5 million Aussies, said no, while 45%, around 5.2 million, said yes to this proposal of a republic. But the year prior to that, there was a constitutional convention in 98, and at that convention there were basically three models that were discussed, and whenever models are talked about in this debate or in this context, it really means on the means of selection, pardon me, for a president to replace a governor general. So there's three models, technically: a direct election, a parliamentary election by a special majority, so a joint sitting of parliament, or an appointment by special council following prime ministerial nomination, so by a council of elders or a sort of esteemed body. But sort of looking back, I guess, more historically about the sort of Republican movement in Australia, it sort of tended to be, you know, back in pre-Federation days, from what you can read, a kind of sentimental abstraction. It was kind of something that was sort of talked about, not really in the modern sense, but in, you know, around the Celtic Club or something like that. And there was a bit of anti-British fervour, but it was nothing to sort of generate any of the groundswell or anything that we would see sort of today. But then you kind of fast forward to the post-1975, and that key date is the dismissal of Gough Whitlam by the then Governor-General Sir Malcolm Kerr. And that really was, I guess, a turning point, in the sense that what you had was now people all of a sudden realising that the Governor-General had these reserve powers and was able to sack the Prime Minister. We'd never really had anything quite like that in Australian history before. I think you sort of really have to go back to probably the Rum Rebellion and Governor Bligh before anything like that sort of, or anything is not, you know, comparable, but anything loosely comparable like that happened. And I think it really cast a spotlight on, again, the powers of the Governor-General and our system of government as a constitutional monarchy, and the Governor-General having those powers. And of course, there's a lot of circumstances around that, and I presume we might jump into it. But that's the sort of key dates, and the distinction is, again, you had in the pre-Federation era, it was a sentimental abstraction, this Republican idea. Post-1975, it gathered a bit of pace. But then coming into the 1990s and the referendum in 1999, this sort of, there were a few sort of swirling things, the approaching of the Olympics, these questions of national identity emerging. And of course, in the 1990s, Paul Keating was Australia's Prime Minister. And he was someone who, I guess, was very progressive in some of his views, especially around Australia's cultural identity. And, you know, he said that a republic could really signify our coming of age as a nation, really could broadcast to the region our untethering from Britain, you know, signal our commitment to social justice, to Indigenous or Aboriginal reconciliation, and as well sharpen our image in Asia. So it was sort of like a lot of these factors sort of coming to the fore in the 1990s that was really driving this. And, you know, that's a pretty long list of factors. And, you know, there's sort of a lot of things that a republic could achieve, and I guess it excites a lot of people. But those are the sort of broad circumstances that led to the referendum in 1999. And of course, you know, you asked about the key figures. You know, it's very interesting because things sort of revolve and come around. But Malcolm Turnbull was the, you know, he led the Australian Republican movement quite famously. And the actual model proposed was the Turnbull model. And even in the early 1990s, Tony Abbott was the head of the Australians for Constitutional Monarchy, or ACM. And there's some great YouTube footage that I'll chuck in the show notes there, of them as young men debating each other on this issue. But, you know, I think the key sort of things that popped up, and especially, you know, the key reason that Republicans lost, and many sort of say that it was in the model that I talked about earlier, that there couldn't be really any broad scale agreement by Republicans on what the actual model was, and a bit of disagreement and a bit of disharmony. But I think, you know, most Australians, monarchists or not, sort of advocated pretty persuasively that, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And then also just passionately underscored how our system had served us well, and there wasn't really a compelling case for change. So that's just a bit of a broad primer, Jordan. So I sort of hope that helps in terms of setting the scene.
Yeah, that's great. That's fantastic. And you mentioned the Abbott Turnbull video. For what it's worth, I've watched that, and it's an amazing piece of political history to watch, and you can kind of get a sense of why they were, you know, at loggerheads for so many years afterwards. Like, these two have got, you know, great history, a great contest together. And yeah, I watching that video, like, I'll admit that I was not paying that much attention in 1998-99 about the referendum. And looking back now and, you know, trying to learn more about it, and one of the things I looked at was that debate, and I thought actually Abbott came out on top. I thought he was, you know, he made some really eloquent points, and I think, you know, this isn't really that relevant, but there was a point where Abbott almost seemed shocked that Turnbull went straight for, like, the you know, the low blow political point scoring. Abbott was there expecting a really, you know, constructive debate about the institutions of government, and he just, yeah, it's quite a great video to see.
And I know, it's just, you know, I just want to add to that as a bit of an aside too. It's just probably not related to the actual content of the issue, but you can see how, you know, they're much, much younger men, but their styles, I guess, are quite similar to what they are today. And it's just an interesting Absolutely. Sort of way that how they sort of, their mannerisms of how they conduct themselves, I guess, kind of has permeated throughout their public lives to a degree.
Yeah.
I think that's just another interesting aside. But yes, again, I'll chuck the actual link to the video in the show notes, and viewers or listeners, pardon me, can view for themselves.
Yeah, highly recommend. Now, you've mentioned a couple of things in that sort of brief history, which I wouldn't mind picking up on. You mentioned the Constitutional Convention, and I had no idea there was one. So that I thought that's a pretty interesting piece of history. And I was going to ask you, you know, you mentioned, like, the main thing that was discussed was the different type of models for selecting a head of state. Was that the only thing that was really covered? Like, do you know if there was a broader discussion about, you know, because, like, the selection of a head of state is only one aspect of our political institution. There's so many other things there around separation of powers and, you know, the role of the judiciary and, you know, how many, you know, whether or not the cabinet members need to be part of parliament or could be outside of parliament. Do you know if those things were tackled in a broader sense, or was it really that was the only thing that was up for discussion?
I confess to not having gone over, like, all of the actual Hansard or the minutes of the proceedings, but, you know, I do know that there were a lot of different things floated that were kind of out of bounds a little bit. And even just with the concept more broadly, you know, I mentioned some of the key motivators there, but, you know, people came to convention, from what I understand, wanting to talk, you know, about, you know, sustainability issues or things like that. So a lot of things that were kind of out of bounds. And I think sort of keeping it focused on the model was probably enough for discussion itself. These things might seem like they're basic things to talk about, the models in themselves. But, you know, for example, Richard McGarvey and the McGarvey model of the sort of, you know, council of elders, the tribal elders sort of nominating a person to the prime minister or and, you know, for parliament essentially. You know, there's a lot of legal work involved in that in terms of, you know, what has to change. And, you know, so that, you know, the models by themselves, I think, evoke a lot of legalese and changes to the constitution. But, you know, as far as I'm aware, those, you know, those were the very disciplined things discussed. But, you know, I will definitely, after this, have another look over things. But, you know, I think that's the sort of forum that, and again, I'm pretty sure we'll get to this, but, you know, there's a lot of constitutional related issues where there could be some spring cleaning, for example. And I think that, you know, we've tackled a few of these in terms of a federation episode that we had a few episodes back. But yeah, as far as I'm aware, things kept pretty disciplined to the exact model, which was enough to occupy a lot of the discussion.
Okay. Yeah, let's pick up on the some of the spring cleaning things a bit later. I want to delve a bit more into sort of the current movement for referendum, because the obvious question is, well, if we had this vote, you know, just over 20 years ago, why are we having it again now? Like, is there something that's changed or something that's come up more recently to warrant another referendum, or is there some group or individual who's particularly pushing for the referendum? I mean, I know Scotland have an independence referendum, you know, infrequently. Like, is this the same type of thing? It's just opportunistic, or is there a different reason driving it?
Yeah, look, it's a good question. I think there's a lot of sort of things that are swirling around. I think the Republican question will never, or the concept for it will never actually really sort of go away. It's kind of like the bear at the campsite, you know, that just sort of keeps sort of, maybe we'll ignore it, but it just sort of keeps coming back.
The drop bear. The Republican drop bear.
Saw a few on your travels away, but recently. But yeah, look, I think it's one of these things that's always just going to be sort of kicking around. But look, most obviously it's in the Labor Party manifesto to actually move to become a republic. So, you know, obviously that's what the sort of high stakes game is, this upcoming federal election. So, you know, once it's ensconced in one of the major party platforms, I think that gives a lot of impetus. But I think sort of more broadly, you know, those questions of national identity are always going to be with us. And I think, you know, you only have to tune in to, you know, the Hottest 100 each year, or, you know, when Australia Day revolves around annually, to see the kind of revolving threat that national symbols tend to be exposed to now, in a sort of way that, you know, a lot of people, you know, even just thinking back, you know, you mentioned, Jordan, back to, you know, the late 90s being in school, and, you know, like, these things never really popped up, and not even sort of 10 years ago even, and I think we've sort of spoken about this previously offline, but, you know, a lot of this stuff just didn't really pop up, but now it seems to be a lot more salient. But, you know, like, I think those sort of arguments that we hear today by some of the Republicans trying to lay the groundwork are really, I think, just recycled from the 1990s. So, you know, this idea that Asia's really confused. I wrote a piece on this recently. Again, I'll put a link to it. But by a lot of Australian business leaders who are saying that, you know, Asia's confused by our attachment to the constitutional monarchy, which is a bit sort of puzzling to me, because it's a place of the world where tradition, you know, and culture, I guess, are very heavily respected. But that's not a new argument. You know, this idea that system is an affront to Indigenous Australia, that's not a new argument. And indeed, a lot of Indigenous Australians have found tradition in a constitutional monarchy. People like Neville Bonner, was Australia's first federal Aboriginal parliamentarian. And then just what I think that a lot of Republicans tend to fasten themselves to is this, that we're somehow at the whim of a family lineage, like a family in the UK, in Britain, the royal family, and that we're somehow untethered. That's, again, not a new argument, but it sort of, those are the sort of the three themes that keep popping up from the Republican side. So I don't think that they're terribly new arguments, but they certainly get sort of washed off, and I think mashed together with, you know, what is a palpable frustration with current politics and how reactive things are, you know, a scepticism, if not a sort of lack of trust in our public institutions, or a lack of awareness about what they actually do, and I think some swelling kind of demographic changes. So I think it's a fusion of old and new here, that's what's sort of driving this again. In 2019.
Yeah, it sounds like it's kind of riding the flavour of the times in a lot of other areas.
Sure.
You mentioned the that it's a part of the Labor Party policy manifesto. Mm-hmm. Do you have any idea whether, you know, the groups like the Greens have a certain stance on this subject, or whether there's any? I mean, Malcolm Turnbull's, you know, obviously a Liberal. Are there any sort of key Liberal figures today which align with the Republican movement, or is it really more a left of centre position?
Yeah, look, I think, you know, it's not really, I guess, yeah, it kind of doesn't cross party lines. I mean, hence the sort of early debate from sort of Turnbull and Abbott there. But, you know, I guess Turnbull's commitment to the Liberal Party was kind of questioned at the time, and he ended up joining the Liberal Party and, of course, becoming Prime Minister.
It was questioned throughout his career in a way, really.
True. That's right. And, you know, look, I think that this is something that where I think probably people would be very surprised at the amount of people who are formal members of the Liberal Party who would support a republic. I think, you know, when you look at this debate last time, it was almost an exclusively very progressive, elitist, what you might say, cause. We had a lot of sort of editors of newspapers, a lot of entertainers, a lot of politicians being very supportive of it. And I don't think that's kind of different this time round. Them having a very different view to just the Australian people, and I think hence why it's very important to put this sort of thing to the people and not just leave it up to, I guess, plebiscite or the decision makers in for a legislative change, for example. But I think people would be surprised about how many people, in the Liberal Party in particular, who'd be enthusiastic about a republic.
Sure. We're at risk here of getting too, too wonkish with our discussion. So let's step back a bit, and I'll give you an opportunity to make a case for why this subject, not necessarily, the constitutional monarchy case, but the broader question of our political institutions, about whether we should be a republic or a monarchy, why people should even care about this question. Like, will it really have any tangible impact on people's everyday lives, or is this more of a broader cultural issue that's at stake?
Look, I think that, putting the framework of will it affect people's everyday lives, like this is clearly not an issue that has much to do with the level of marginal tax you're going to pay. But it's no less very important. And I remember Lloyd Waddy, the late former New South Wales minister, who was a great advocate of the Crown, but said that you don't learn about how marriage works by studying a certificate. And I thought it was a really useful way or framework to look at this sort of public discussion. But it's not just about, of course, on paper institutions, but it talks about our history, our civic life, the national myths and stories we tell each other. Again, these things are actually really vital and important to, I guess, our national character and national ethos. And I think, where this actually might affect people in their everyday lives is that, it would actually cause us a lot more of a functional headache than what some people might realise. So, you might just think that exchanging the Governor General with a president, that where we have a lot, people or some form of public expression puts in place, whether that's a prime ministerial endorsement or parliamentary endorsement, or some form of popular sentiment. I think what this inevitably invites, and this is one of the chief downfalls that I see with going down this Republican slippery slope, is that you actually start to create this sense of a president operating with a mandate. And I think that can be a pretty dangerous thing. And I think we'll look at a few different examples later about how, things have really parted ways with best intentions on that front. But, you look back to 1975, again, we've only had one major constitutional crisis like this, where the Governor General, Malcolm Kerr, sacked the Prime Minister Gough Whitlam. And I sort of pull back from that and just go, look, that's the example of what could be at stake. This is the merits of the issue aside. That's an example of what could be at stake if you have someone in a position like the Governor General, or they're called a president, whatever they're called, who's playing an active role in political affairs. And that was a tricky issue. Again, I don't want to jump into the specifics of that because it was went to this sort of intractable stalemate without being able to. Whitlam couldn't pass supply, so things were literally intractable. So that was the only decision I think Kerr could properly make. But it was incredibly wrenching and divisive issue. I don't look at that with any sort of glee and sort of rub my hands together and go, yeah, that was a great example of. I think it was a very divisive issue, but more at its broadest level, I think it's an example of what could happen, the characteristics of what could happen if we had an activist head of state, which I don't think, again, how many people are affected by Whitlam being sacked? It's hard to gauge, really, in terms of what specific functional everyday impact it had on people. But, the psychological impact enough. It's something that we don't want to repeat, regardless, I think, of what side of politics you're on. So, it's not a specific tangible impact in any way that, marginal tax or anything like that, but no less very important.
I'm sure that before that, the events, the dismissal of 1975, most people didn't even know there was a Governor General. I'm sure that was a kind of a catalyst for people thinking, what is this part of our institutions? How did this happen? How could the Prime Minister be kicked out? So, yeah, I can understand how that was a catalyst for some of these questions to come up.
And
But
and just quickly there, like there's a lot of things that people learn, I think, about the govern, and I still sort of learn like little conventions and things like that and how things kind of work that are just really surprising in our system. You know, I've been sort of closely following things for a while now, but, you know, there was even, I remember once, for example, being at a dinner in Brisbane where Paul de Jersey, as the governor of Queensland, was acting governor general because he was the next most senior in Australia, because Peter Grosgrove was overseas at the time. And, you know, he said that he had to get home to go to bed because he had to be up at sort of 4:30 or 5 a.m. because that's when Cosgrove was coming back into Australian airspace, and they had to be woken up to sign over the responsibility, to sign for responsibility from back to the Governor General from being at. So there's all these sort of quirky conventions like that. You know, when you go to, say, head of state, for example, it's something I did a few years ago when, you know, you think of the Prime Minister, when it's not actually. So there's all these sort of little quirky things that I think, you know, probably a lot of people don't have a lot of knowledge on. But yeah, you're right. It's just, look, it's something that I have to, you know, I find out new things all the time about.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Like that small distinction you point out there between the head of state and the head of government, you kind of like, most people are like, what the hell? Same person. Yeah. So yeah, and I guess this is one of the virtues of going back and reading something like the actual constitution and learning more about the subtleties of how our our governing institutions are set up. There's all these sort of little things you wouldn't expect. But just going back to your answer to that question, it sounds like, you know, you pointed out a lot of the sort of the flaws or dangers with the proposed Republican movement. It sounds like you see this not just as a cultural matter, but also a question of, like, you know, what constitutes good government in a practical everyday sense, and you think that this has implications in that forum too. So maybe this is a good way for you to kind of, I'll give you the opportunity to lay out what you think are the main reasons in favour of remaining a constitutional monarchy and, you know, of not having a referendum at all.
Yeah, look, I sort of think that, you know, my arguments, I hope, are actually pretty simple or pretty straightforward for remaining a constitutional monarchy. You know, like, at first I'm really proud of Australia and what we've achieved as a nation, and even in the colonies before Federation, I think we've been incredibly stable, tolerant, open, you know, an incredibly successful nation. And I think we owe a lot of that to Britain and a lot of that to the Crown and the stability that's been provided in that time. And I sort of always go back to, you know, don't take my word for it, but you can even ask Bob Hawke and what he said in 1988. Bob Hawke, of course, was, you know, one of the great Labor prime ministers, but I'll just quote here because I think it's just such an important point to make. But he said that in pinpointing what makes us distinctly Australian, we acknowledge the enormous debt we owe to Britain. Britain has given us the basis of many of the institutions of our free society, our system of parliamentary democracy, the principles of rule of law, and the protection and the rights of the individual under the law, our system of liberal education. And, you know, I find it really actually hard to disagree, but I think taking us down the Republican path would do three things. First, it would over-politicise a position that's above politics. It would, you know, culturally disregard the things that, you know, Hawke mentions there that have made us a success. And I think just thirdly, it would create a distraction from the more pressing economic, social and political issue. So I think this, but it really just loops back to the sort of first point that I made, and that's just that we've been incredibly successful in terms of sound government and sound institutions, and at the top of that is the Crown in our system. And you know, so I just sort of base a lot of my beliefs or thoughts on that, on us just being really proud of what we've done here and what we've done as a nation, and the Crown's been with us every step of that journey.
So this is probably my first opportunity to push back on you a little bit. So I accept your point and Hawke's point about
be gentle, how we've inherited. Be gentle.
Be gentle. I'll build. I like this point about how we've inherited these great institutions from the British, and, you know, Hawke, you know, lines that very eloquently. And I think, yeah, there's a great case for saying that's underpinned our prosperity and our free society. But I'm not so convinced that necessarily precludes us from becoming a republic. I feel like there's still scope for us to maybe move in that direction, but still retain our, you know, our British political history. And I'll use an example to demonstrate my point. One obvious case is how the United States transitioned from a constitutional monarchy or a colony of the UK into becoming a, you know, a functional republic. And so it was able to, you know, make this transition, but still keep a lot of its British political heritage. And from what I've read, like the best example of this is that most of the Americans, the American revolutionaries, they saw themselves as like reasserting their political rights as Englishmen. That's how they defined their revolution. So in a way, they thought they were more British than the British. Mm. And so my question for you is, given that example, you know, what type of you know, lesson can we draw from these examples, like the United States? Is that case relevant to us in our decision of whether or not to become a republic or stay a monarchy? Is it different? Is it the same? Or how do you think about that?
Yeah, look, it's a good point to make, I think. You know, and what you've just reminded me about is, you know, you even look, you know, I think America and even Australia, for example, is a successful nation because we can appeal to these principles. You know, like Martin Luther King arguably was more American than most Americans because he was appealing to those, you know, traditions and that appeal of sort of liberty that the founding fathers had instilled. And, you know, back to Frederick Douglass and, you know, reading the Declaration and these sorts of things. And, you know, you can see a lot of parallels of that in our system. I guess, you know, and maybe that's a good actual response. I mean, you look, for example, at someone like Neville Bonner, who I touched on before. You know, he was Australia's first federal Indigenous parliamentarian and a devout or committed monarchist. And his big argument was that, you know, when you ask people to assimilate, ask people to integrate, you have certain sort of goalposts. And then once you change the system and you change it up, again, symbolically, it might not mean like much from a functional perspective, but you do change by changing our symbols. Where the goalposts actually are and where people need to assimilate and integrate. So, yeah, look, I agree. There could be elements, you're right, where we could maintain some of our tradition and our heritage and character, but do that within a republican framework. It could be possible. But, I think we'll get to this, but to sort of jump ahead a little bit, that's not the kind of lesson that we learn from converting to, a republic. A lot of the nations that have shed their monarchist heritage and gone down the republican route have succumbed to tyranny and poor governance. And I'm not suggesting that could happen overnight in Australia, but it's certainly the key, I think, lesson is, best intentions don't always turn out that way when it comes to going down the republican path. I mean, America, I think that it's important to note as well that they did fight a war of independence against the British that, about the same time that we finished up about the same time that Arthur Phillip was going to pull into Sydney as part of the First Fleet. So we kind of learnt, I guess, some of the distinctions of that, and we've made some of the elements of the British system culturally fit onto the Australian soil a lot better, and I think in a lessons learned sense. But, you know, I think the relative, and this goes back to, I think, the good governance or the case that can be made for a monarchy or constitutional monarchy, just the simplicity that we have in our system, that the Americans, you know, you look at the American political system and, it's a very noisy democracy, as good democracies should be. But you have, you know, lots of, I guess I would say, a lot of inefficiencies compared to the Australian system and a lot of complexities. So, you know, the active judicial arm, for example, super PACs and an electoral college, a very complex voting system that's very hard to decipher, that we just simply don't have here, and super PACs and things like that. And, you know, a lot of complexity around, say, for example, judicial appointments. I remember reading in Lazarus Rising, I think George W. Bush was talking to John Howard about this and going, and, you know, he said that, is about to have a pretty bruising, someone was coming up for a pretty bruising confirmation hearing on the Supreme Court. And, he asks, Bush asks Howard, how is it done in Australia? And he goes, oh, well, it's done all by executive appointment. So it's basically the PM and Cabinet's call about appointing a judge to the High Court. And I think
Howard, barely gets mentioned in the news.
Yeah, and look, Bush, expressed wistful envy, quote unquote, apparently at a system like that. But I think it's just a symbolic snapshot of the simplicity of our system and the good governance that's created and the stability that's created in Australia over time. And, I think that would sort of be, I think that's a pretty decent case to make. Again, I guess with that precedent that we'll get to about things sort of falling apart and things going down that slippery slope, it just sort of seems that the lesson of history is, it's things don't turn out with the best intended or the best intentions in mind, and especially on an issue like this.
I think you got a good point. I like your point there about the sort of the little subtleties of our system when you compare it to the UK or the US. It has, these little benefits that you might not really appreciate, like something as simple as the election of judges and stuff like that. So, yeah, there's all these unique aspects of our constitutional system which make ours better or worse than other systems. But you used a term which I really liked there, which was cultural fit. And I think when you talk about the test of, the right test for assessing whether or not we should be a monarchy or a republic, I think cultural fit is a perfect way to think about it. And so that raises the question, if you looked at, Australia in the early 1900s or the United States in the late 1700s, the idea is that their institutions, their constitution and these political institutions were fitted to that cultural context. And so that raises the question of, well, a lot of time has passed in both nations since those constitutions, and has our culture changed or evolved to an extent where our constitution no longer fits with our cultural context? Is that a case that you would buy into, that maybe as a society we have changed so much that it's time to update or amend our constitutional structure to suit the times, and maybe that means moving to a republic?
Yep. No, look, it's a good point, and I think you look at, for example, but what you're saying though has actually been factored in or talked about before. For example, you look at demographic changes, and a lot of people said, like back in, say, Victoria, when or like even just now, for example, one of the points I talked about at the start was demographic changes, and it's like we have more Australians who are born overseas now, more and more Australians from Asia. And it's sort of like, are our symbols and is our system of governance appropriate? And again, that is something that's been with us since the 1850s, that question. I believe I looked at the numbers on this just recently, but back in the 1850s or the 1850s, I believe, sort of right on the cusp of the gold rush in Victoria, the majority of the population, of course, the influx of new migrants were from Britain. But then the second behind them, and almost a quarter of the Victorian population was, or a third, I think, from China or from Chinese born. But, that didn't necessitate, a huge change in our governance institutions. It actually made us more prosperous, made us more of a success, I think, as a nation, or as a, pre-federation, as a colony. And these sort of things, like, I think were a bit of a beacon of stability. And I think, you touched on it before, Jordan, about having that appeal to liberty. That's something that doesn't owe anything to demographic changes, but it's actually a hugely persuasive thing for people to fasten themselves to, regardless of the demographics or regardless, people want to find something to attach themselves to. And I think the crown has this universal appeal and this universal symbol, you look at the Commonwealth, for example, and how attractive and persuasive the symbol, pardon me, of the crown is across a lot of different cultures there. And I think that sort of, I think that some of the answer lies in that it's universally appealing, regardless of the year and regardless of the time, because you're appealing to traditions and ideas that cross national boundaries, cross cultures, and definitely cross incomes. So I think that, the changes you're talking about have been with us before, whether demographics or, you know, cultural changes. But I think as well that those are the sorts of changes that can take place within the framework of a constitutional monarchy in a lot better way than, or a lot more refined way than a republic. But look, it's a great point, I think, and a good question. I just sense it's been, a lot of it has been answered before.
You make a, make a good point there about kind of the timeless nature of some of these things. Mm. And you know, when we talk about cultural fit, maybe the symbol of the crown and the monarchy is one of those timeless cultural traditions that doesn't necessarily need to be reaching for 20 or 30 years. It's something that has a bit more sustainability to it. So I think that's an interesting point. But now I'm going to, that Charlie Munger is one of my heroes, and his maxim is always invert. So I'm going to get you to put yourselves in the Republican camp, and I want you to think what you find the strongest argument about the Republican case. Is there anything that you find very persuasive in their argument for changing our system of government?
Yeah, look, one of the things I always sort of think about, and the more you study history, and again, I'm learning lots of new things because I'm certainly not a scholar, but, I think historically we've done very well over many centuries to actually move away from total monarchist rule to rule by consent. That's been a hard pitched battle, and I think we've got to a good balance now. But, you know, it sort of goes right back to the Magna Carta or the first Magna Carta and the few that came after that as well, about this sort of tussle between, rule by decree, which has been the dominant theme throughout human affairs and human history, to rule by consent. It's a very sort of new concept or idea, but I think we've got to a sort of good space. But, I like the enthusiasm that a lot of Republicans have about Australia, you know, what they're trying to achieve in terms of a better profile of the country, to renew and retool. But I guess sort of my thing is, you know, why can't they do that within the tradition that we have? Richard McGarvey, I think I touched on him at the start, the late Richard McGarvey was someone who I think was a really persuasive Republican, but he was sort of very, very intelligent about the change that was needed. And, you know, he had a very strong grasp of Australian history and especially the Australian legal context that we have. And unfortunately, I don't sort of see anyone like that in the Republican movement today. And I just sort of sense, you know, with thinking with Charlie Munger's inversion cap in mind, you know, the simplicity of the case, of the Republicans' case, is very appealing, I think, to a lot of people. You know, it's simply, you know, at the most base level, getting Parliament to approve the Governor General and not the Queen. And, you know, I think, it's not so simple, obviously, but I think it's an easy case to put in front of people. So, again, thinking with the inversion cap in mind, those are sort of some of the elements that I think, you know, that are persuasive to people.
Yeah, it sounds like you actually like some of the enthusiasm for, you know, trying to, how'd you describe it, renew and retool some of our institutional infrastructure. But your concern is that they, you know, they need to do it in the traditions that we have. So I might get you to, what do you mean by that? Like, what would be some of the changes that you think actually would work, but keeping the traditions that we have? How would that actually look? Because that's quite a interesting idea to balance, you know, the traditions we have in a constitutional monarchy, but also being able to renew and retool. What type of things did you have in mind,
Matt? Yeah, look, I think there could be some sort of constitutional spring cleaning that could take place that I think is worth looking at. Recognising the executive, for example, and the constitution and the prime minister and these sorts of things, or even actioning some of the discussions around the Federation white paper, you know, for example, that we talked about in a previous episode, you know, power sharing, taxation, the creation of new states. I think these are the sorts of reform discussions that we should be having if we're going to talk about the constitution. The other factor too is, the Indigenous question that I think's been sort of swirling around out there without any sort of clear resolution. And I noted Noel Pearson said, I think it was last year, that it'd be grossly unfair if it came to a if an Indigenous recognition referendum wasn't the first cab off the rank. So, you know, I don't quite sort of agree, but I do, you know, think it's another factor to actually consider when, you know, considering other more pressing priority issues, not so much of a policy nature, but certainly of a constitutional nature, you know, especially around, you know, I know you'd have a lot to say about federation, and as you did on a previous episode, but I would argue those are sorts of more pressing things that we need to talk about within the goalposts of the constitutional system that we have.
Sure. I might take this opportunity now to go into bat for the Republicans a bit. Sure. So if, from what you've made some pretty convincing cases about the benefits of holding on to our traditions and our customs that are built up through, you know, the British mm-hmm. political system. And that, you know, you're reminding me of the lessons of F.A. Hayek, the great economist, and he talked about there's a lot of wisdom and knowledge built up in traditions mm-hmm. that have, you know, emerged over time. Things like law and language and culture, these things have you know, inherent knowledge built into them because they've had time to adapt and evolve. And, you know, constitutional monarchy can be seen as one of those things that have got that time-tested wisdom of, you know, built into them. And I see that, you know, that's a very conservative idea about how complex systems of, you know, change through time. You can balance that on the other side of the coin, which is the progressive ideas about, you know, looking towards the future and how do we change things for the better. And that I kind of see coming out in the Republican movement. It's like, you know, our system, sure, we've got these established systems, but we can do better. We can, you know, make our constitutional structure, you know, take us to a new stage of prosperity. It's not just, you know, not just what we've achieved in the past. And that tension, I remember Hayek wrote in a paper, it was titled "Why I Am Not a Conservative," and he said, "Conservatives believe in evolution up to the present, but not in the future." And I kind of see that coming out in this type of debate. It's like we're very happy to accept the wisdom of, you know, institutions established through time, but we're not willing to tinker with them going forward. And so, you know, where can we have the scope to, as you say, renew and retool and, you know, keep that tradition there? And so, for me, it's more about the process. How do we get to a stage where we can balance this, you know, this inner sense of innovation and moving forward with the tradition and custom of the past. So I feel like you may be overweighting the benefits of the constitutional monarchy tradition and underweighting the scope for, you know, change in the future. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, no, I think it's interesting, you know, like, you know, for example, the Hayek point, you know, what people sort of tend to not realize is that he was sort of talking about the European, like a European continental brand of conservatism versus the, I guess, North American brand of conservatism. So they're two very sort of distinctive traditions. And I think I see Australia's tradition in the sense of that sort of North American sense of conservatism, which is sustaining liberty and appealing to those liberal traditions that you talked about before, Jordan. So, you know, if we had adopted the continental conservatism approach in our institutions, I think we would have gone down that sort of route of, you know, where France has ended up, for example, or the Germans' Weimar Republic that, you know, quickly succumbed to tyranny, or we would have adopted some of those very baked in and stuck on characteristics of, you know, decrepit, you know, monopolized institutions. But because we didn't adopt that in Australia, that we've got a lot more space for flourishing, a lot more space for innovation and change and reform, like you talk about. And you look at some of the seismic changes that have taken place within Australian history, you know, not just on the economy and things, you know, of, you know, opening up to the world, but, you know, changes around race, attitudes and cultural attitudes around race, you know, immigration and these sorts of things. Like, these are huge seismic changes that have taken place within Australia, but they've taken place within, again, our scaffolding or framework of institutions that respect tradition but also respect liberty. And I think, again, those changes have been able to take place because of that appeal to liberty and that appeal to liberty is enshrined in our institutions. So I guess, you know, being a monarchist doesn't sort of mean that you're rusted on to just tradition at all costs. I think it's really foolish to live that way, and a lot of people would agree. But it really just means having a respect for your institutions, but then respecting enough, knowing when it's time to change. But you can do a lot of that within the institutional framework of a constitutional monarchy like Australia, precisely because we haven't gone down that same conservative path as what Hayek was criticising. We've actually adopted a very liberalistic approach in our institutions here, which I think have been both down and upstream of Australian culture.
And it sounds like you're not completely hostile to the idea of, you know, this progressive attitude of, like when you talk about spring cleaning of our constitutional infrastructure and renewing, retooling, it's like you recognize the dangers of being too stuck in the past and you have to have one eye on the future. I think it sounds like you're more hostile to the idea of the type of utopian idealism that we can design everything perfectly, you know, from scratch and just discard the past. And I think, you know, example of the French Revolution, Edmund Burke, the famous conservative political figure, he talked about the French Revolution as succumbing to this problem of wanting to remake everything from scratch, like, and discarding the past, and it ended up leading to tyranny. And you could say the same thing about the Russian Revolution. And so then it's interesting to compare that with, say, the American revolution and their experience, where they went from, you know, they tried to maintain their, you know, their historical heritage and combine it with an eye towards the future. Do you agree with that?
No, look, it's a good point. I'm glad you brought it up because, you know, the French are on their fifth republic since the revolution. And, you know, Thomas Paine, I remember, wrote to Jefferson in 1793, and he said that, you know, had this revolution been conducted consistently with its principles, there was once a good prospect of extending liberty throughout the greatest part of Europe, but I now relinquish that hope. And, you know, Paine, of course, was one of the revolution's biggest advocates. So, you know, again, I guess it gets back to that element of, you know, best intentions, you know, what people have really great ideals, and this, you know, sounds like a fantastic idea to a lot of people and it's very appealing, but I think things quickly part ways with what the best intentions are and we'll pay for it in terms of poor governance and governance failures going forward.
And to me, this again raises this question of process for constitutional change. And so, you know, in order to avoid the failures of, you know, the sort of French example or the Russian example, and trying to balance that with the American example, you know, it's like, what does that process look like so that we avoid those issues? And the process that's being proposed here is just a referendum. We have a vote on whether or not we become a republic or stay as we are. And for me, like all these types of elections, they usually end up in completely unrelated areas, and we're debating stuff that is not necessarily the substance of the issue. And I'm worried that a referendum might end up being more about Meghan Markle's latest tweet than about our actual political institution. So I was wondering, do you have any thoughts about, you know, if we're going to take this idea of spring cleaning and renewing or retooling, is there another process apart from a referendum that you think might be able to balance these conservative and progressive instincts?
Yeah, look, I think, you know, it's a good point. I mean, you don't have to be, you know, I guess a royalist to respect the monarchist tradition. Or sort of be up to speed on the royal family, or know the sort of all the ins and outs. So, or what's sort of hot right now. But, you know, I guess sort of my hope is what, you know, a good outcome of what this discussion could be is a bit of a departure from everyday politics and reactive kind of politics. And I think this could really bring a more optimistic discussion about what it is that makes our country great. And, you know, I think that's, you know, this could as well sort of provoke a bit of civic discussion, or much needed civic discussion around, you know, a reintroduction of gratitude about where we've been successful. But then I think, you know, maybe back to some, you know, the public art of persuasion, and this being a really good discussion on institutions and these sorts of things, which I think was sort of largely done in the sense of the 1998 Constitutional Convention. It sort of got a bit sort of, I think it gets a bit technical and quite heavy at times. But you know, I do think that that could be a pretty decent outcome of what could actually happen here, as opposed to what sort of typically happens when covering, I guess, electoral politics and the sort of slide into consumption politics that we see a lot today.
Yeah, I think your optimism might be a bit misplaced there, Sean. I'm a bit more skeptical. You reminded me of our podcast about whether a Hawke or a Keating or Howard would survive in today's political game. And I fear that, yeah, the nature of the game today means that something like this would, this referendum would end up being an ugly contest. And I think for me, Brexit is a perfect illustration of how that might play out. It ends up being about issues not necessarily on point. And then if there was if the referendum went in favour of a change, how does that actually play out? Like the Brexit scenario has shown that voting in favour of constitutional change is one thing compared to actually implementing it. And I mean, how many years is it now where they've been back and forth through Parliament and, you know, it's not quite clear which way they're going to go. And it might end up looking very different to actually leaving the EU. So there seems to be a whole bunch of other issues here. How do you see that?
Yeah, well, actually, just on the Brexit thing, I see Nigel Farage is stepping back into the fray. You know, and he said that he'd given up or had ruined his life. You know, 25 years that he'd given to the cause, and then he sort of couldn't possibly, you know, step back and watch it all ruin. So he's coming back into it, which is very interesting. But yeah, you're right. Look, I think Brexit's clearly been a logjam. You know, it's kind of vote for one thing and then work out the details later. And, you know, arguably the details shouldn't be as complex, but, you know, this is, I didn't want to sort of cover off on Brexit here, but it's a take your instructive example there. But I think our system here actually enables us to avoid things like Brexit, but, you know, first by not signing up to a supranational regional body like that at the expense or the ultra expense of sovereignty that the UK has done with the EU. But I think, you know, secondly, and I touched on this before about avoiding that sort of logjam politics, one of the extra layer cakes to the complexities of a US system or a US republic, for example, has been, you know, there've been 21 government shutdowns, I think. I'm not sure if it's 21 or 22. But, you know, we've had one shutdown here in 1975 and when Whitlam was sacked. And, you know, that was, you know, the Governor General stepping in and a double dissolution eventually being called. And our democracy went to where it needed to go after a very sort of turbulent time, and it went back to the people. You know, and I think that's another example of the simplicity that we have built into our system versus republics. And that's a sort of very general observation. But, you know, I have seen a lot of American commentators, for example, again, look at the Australian system and go, oh, okay, well, they've had a shutdown there and this is what happened. And they had an election and it sorted it out eventually. But you just sort of don't have that logjam in that sense of government shutdowns. And in a sense, I wouldn't, you know, we wouldn't have the same kind of logjam around Brexit because we have a very refined system that I don't think would push us into a situation like that in the first place.
I get your point about how our system has some advantages which should avoid the issues that you know, we've seen in Britain or the US. But I think if you put that to one side, I think you'd agree that there's still scope for positive reform in the sense, like, you know, you mentioned the federalism stuff, and you know, it's not like our government doesn't have its issues, and you know, a lot of there's budget deficits and all these sorts of things which are, you know, in need of, yeah, there's definitely scope for institutional design that might remedy some of these issues. So in the spirit of bipartisanship, like the last point here, can you think of any sort of whether it's a different type of process to the referendum or just a way that maybe both monarchists and republicans can move forward together? Is there something you can see, a way you can see where we can get change without, you know, without unconstructive debate?
Yeah, look, I think, you know, the points I made before, the spring, and like you just mentioned then, Jordan, the spring cleaning thing, I think they could find a bit of bipartisanship there. But then, you know, I just sort of sense that it could provoke a bit of appreciation, I hope, about, I think that would be a great a great outcome of this public discussion. And I hope I'm not being, again, too optimistic here, but I think people can come, but hopefully come through this with a better sense of appreciation of the role of the Constitution, the role of the Crown in our affairs, and how beneficial that has been to us as a nation, and how much we've rode the success of that. And the other, you know, the point is that, you know, you don't have to, and I made it just before, that you don't have to be obsessed with the rules to appreciate that. And I think, you know, it's a mistake to, I guess, correlate, you know, public enthusiasm with with public enthusiasm for the Australian Constitution. But, you know, I just hope at the end of the day that what we might be able to get out of this is, again, that satisfaction about how fortunate we are to be Australians.
Yeah, that's a great summary. I might conclude with some of my own final thoughts. I think the part that's missing in all this is an actual discussion of the way we change our constitution. So, you know, it's a referendum is one way, but I think there are other potential ways that we could go about remedying, you know, whatever issues there might be in our political institutions today, and doing it in a way where we hold on to the traditions of the constitutional monarchy. And, you know, because for me, I think I empathize a bit with the Republican movement about, you know, maybe there are things that could be better, like whether it's a head of state and a head of government, like we have a president, you know, it could be done in a way where it actually works quite well. I don't necessarily see that, you know, maybe the models that were proposed previously had flaws in them, but I think there's still scope for change. And there's other features of like the US system that I quite like. For example, the fact that the ministers are, you know, don't have to be sitting in parliament. I feel like that means they've got a greater choice of expertise. So I think there's all these little things that, you know, could be adapted or could be, you know, incrementally added on to what we have already, but it's the process of how we go about that. So you think about the US example again, and, you know, they had a constitutional convention and they had certain delegates, and it was a process that went over years. It wasn't a bloody revolution like in France. And so maybe we need to think more about the process of constitutional change rather than the change itself. And for people who are interested in that, you know, the one economist I like is the late James Buchanan. He wrote a lot about constitutional choice and what that means and how we get there. And, you know, for me, I think like it's kind of like due process in a court of law, and the, you know, which is essential to the administration of justice. Like due process of institutional change is also essential to a free and prosperous society. So I think these are more the questions we should be considering rather than, you know, whether we vote yes or no. I reckon that's in danger of becoming more like a Brexit situation. So that's my final thoughts.
Yep. No, they're really good points. And I think if you can send me some James Buchanan stuff, Jordan, that'd be great, and I can put it in the show notes. And and one thing just provoked a thought for me too was, you know, Richard McGarvey, he wrote a great book on this. The name escapes me right now, but I have cited it before in some of my writing. But you know, like I guess some of the details about where the institutions might be refined and what would need to be refined for that to take place, which is a much more, I guess, detailed or complex discussion than a yes, no thing. But, you know, I guess that's where these things eventually end up, because, you know, there's a small ballot paper and people need to make a choice ultimately. But you just hope that, you know, some of the long-form debate that this could provoke would lead to a good yes-no choice that's sort of well thought out and there's a lot of background on, and that where we do have, you know, people are extremely informed, and out of this process we could identify other reforms that could take place.
Yeah, and I guess my thought is that there's the danger of having just a yes or no vote is that, you know, we decide, you know, people vote yes and then the actual details of the Republic get, you know, sent off to a committee and they come up with all sorts of draconian institutional measures, which, you know, might make it a lot worse. So, if there was a, you know, going back to this idea of cultural fit, if we can think of a process which suits our, you know, our society and our culture and we're happy with that, and, you know, then let the constitutional convention or whatever it is play out, that would be really exciting. Thinking about how that would, I think that's more the first step of the matter rather than just going straight to a referendum.
And, you know, just on that actually, and you know, we're sort of wrapping up, but it, you know, it could provoke this idea of, you know, I guess People sort of think of a 2020 summit or something like that, or you get a group of people together who are leaders in their field, and it sort of just becomes a bit of a night, like a blue sky event versus it being nuts and bolts. When I think what you're sort of talking about needs to be sort of a bit more nuts and bolts, or a bit more identifiable with good, proper processes or practices that could be changed, versus being too sort of eye in the sky with thinking.
Yeah, and grounded in sort of our legal system as well. Mm. Like, you don't want some, like a G20 style communique. That's kind of the worst scenario. Yeah, you want something that is, is going to come out of our existing infrastructure.
Yep.
Then you've got a more incremental, evolutionary type change going on. Because, for me, the problem with saying, we're going back a bit over, I'll ground a bit now, but the problem with just sticking, saying, we should stick with the constitutional monarchy because that's what we've always had. Mm. If you maintain that too strictly, it means that you would never have had Australia in the first place. Like, there was some, there was sort of some intelligent design, there was some eye to the future in the conception of Australia, and the same with the United States. So, yeah, it's like, how do you balance that conservative and progressive tendency?
Yeah. No, that's right. So, yep. Very good point. Well, I guess you'll gracefully hand the interviewer's mic back over to me, but I thoroughly enjoyed that, Jordan. I think it was really good, and I hope for listeners as well, a bit of a, what I hope not too biased, a primer on the background of this very, what could be a very, very important issue over the next month, or I guess we'll find out in a month or so.
Yeah, thanks for letting me take the reins of the short. I mean, it was good to pick your brain about some of the history of this. And, this is one subject that I find interesting but I haven't read very far. So, yeah, you certainly shed a lot of light of the case for constitutional monarchy and the history there. But I hope listeners think I push back on you enough to make this, worthwhile listening to.
Absolutely. I genuinely appreciate it, Jordan. And it's good to have you back, and look forward to chatting soon. And, of course, for other listeners out there, please don't be scared to get in touch at seanjacobs.com.au and let us know your thoughts about whether we hit the right tones with this one, or if there are any more questions you want to ask, or any points you want to make on the Republic versus monarchy debate in Australia. So thanks very much, and Jordan, take care.
Thanks, Sean.